content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anadine Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And today, we are going to start with the topic. The chapter is Death and Afterlife, which is for November and December in the garden. And our topic is Conifers I Have Known. What I do not know about conifers could fill a book almost as big and weighty as the Royal Horticultural Society Encyclopedia of Conifers, which is 1,507 pages and crammed with more than 8,000 cultivars representing the world's 615 species. Funny, then, that the first thing I planted here was a conifer, and a rare one at that. I carried a Japanese umbrella pine, which isn't a pine at all, a hint at why I have trouble learning my conifers, out of the moving van, dug a hole, and that was the start of a garden. I knew nothing at all when I heaved the then very unusual chest-high young Sciadopides verticillata out of the ground, in the borough of Queens in New York City, two zones to the south, and plopped it unceremoniously into a bushel basket for the trip several hours north. Of course, I didn't know then that where the Japanese umbrella pine and I were headed was two zones colder, because I didn't know anything about zones that... There was nothing but one giant rhododendron alone behind the house, and I made the umbrella pine its companion, hoping they would get along. There was no back porch then. There was nothing but high grass and invasive wild blackberries tangled throughout it. And my youthful enthusiasm, the house was a wreck, about 15 feet from where the tree now stands, about 25 feet tall was a giant crater where the back foundation had collapsed. Excuse me. Today, the umbrella pine is the most asked about plant on my website and in my garden, mostly for its unusual appearance. Its needles are arranged in whorls, like the spokes in an umbrella, hence the name. And everyone wants to know more about the tree over there with the plastic-looking needles, since they're so thick and lustrous. Technically, it also has another kind of leaf, the tiny scale leaves on the stems, but nobody notices those. I thank this Sciadopides every day for holding up to 30-plus winters of uneasy snow loads and countless ice storms, not suffering windburn in the spot I chose, and settled in without so much as losing a needle. Umbrella pines hail from cloud forests in Japan, where rainfall and humidity are both high. so it won't cooperate with drought and wants babying in the first year or two after transplanting, plus in the warmer end of its range, zone 5 to 7 or 8, protection from the midday sun. Oh, and one more expert tip. Skip the stupid moving can caper I somehow got away with. None of the conifers in the following list arrived in a moving van, but all have made themselves at home. In addition, for fastest screening, I use Thuja plicata, Western red cedar, and, surprise again, not a cedar. For greatest wildlife value, I recommend the native to me Eastern red cedar, except it's a juniper, Juniperus virginiana. Other standbys, trees and shrubs. And here's a list of the ones that she says are good. Is concolor fir, which is the bluest of all blues, nearly turquoise and soft needles. The dwarf eastern white pine, which is nana. White pines that don't grow into trees, but rather a mounded bonsai-like shape. There are many newer-named cultivars with a slow-growing habit. The golden spreading yew, Rapandens aurea, gleaming gold in spring through fall, and as sideways, eventually thigh-high habit. The Korean fir, a pyramidal tree with purple cones, no less. Lacebark pine is mottled, camouflage pattern bark on a long needled pine. Japanese white pine, which is pyramidal when young, then flat-topped and spreading, twisty green or blue needles. The prostrate Japanese plum yew. That's prostata, which is great for ground cover in semi-shade with yew-like texture, but deer resistance. I would grow the upright form too, but it splays open in my snowy winters. Russian arborvita, lacy texture and a ground cover habit in semi-shade, and not an arborvita, which is actually in the genus Thuja and commonly called a cedar. And the last one, oh no, not last, the second to last, is Skylands Oriental Spruce, a pyramidal golden conifer that likes afternoon shade in hot zones. And the Weeping Alaska Cedar, which is pendula, maybe the most graceful conifer. And our next topic is my seed shopping rules. I'm mad about seed, so mad that I require rules for seed shopping. Some are simple and practical to-dos, like I must restrain myself before bringing in the new catalogs until a careful inventory of leftover seed is undertaken to see what I really need. It doesn't always stop me from ordering just one more, fill in the blank, but at least I tried. Most of my rules are a bit more textured and some even political, because not all seed is created equal, either genetically or ethically. in a country where we increasingly ask where our food came from, fostering the growth of farm stands and CSAs and the sales of more organic brands, why don't we ask where our seed comes from? After all, seed is the source of virtually all our food. Whether we actually eat the plant or we feed it to animals who then provide meat, milk, eggs, and even honey. All my rules are really about making the best possible match between the seed I order and the place and way I garden. The first two guidelines are uttered in the hopes of best garden success, since seed is alive and I want to make it feel at home here. Like any living organism, seed adapts genetically over generations to the conditions it is bred and grown in. And my kind of growing season and cultural practices should suit the seed I order as closely as possible. And here are my rules. I buy organic seed when available because I am an organic gardener, and also because I don't want to contribute my dollars to upstream pollution. I use my seed dollars in support of organic farming, as I do with food purchases. Conventional seed farming can be a particularly dirty business, and no surprise. Each crop isn't grown for a mere few weeks or months, like we grow lettuce or broccoli, but instead through its entire life cycle to reproduction age and beyond, meaning that it may encounter more pests and diseases and other pressures along the way. Conventional farmers would potentially intervene with pesticide or fungicide at each such juncture, and also supplement the soil with chemical fertilizers that I don't use, but the seed might have come to expect. I seek out regionally appropriate varieties too, reading the fine print, not just for days to harvest to suit my season length, but also for whether it was developed for northern growers in particular, always a bonus. I use the example of a cattle farmer in Minnesota. He wouldn't go to Texas to purchase livestock. Texas cattle are adapted to thriving in a hotter and drier world. A cold, hardier breed would be more suitable. Nope. This doesn't mean I don't try regional specialties from elsewhere. Southern greasy beans or an heirloom pepper from the desert southwest are definitely on my wish list. I just don't rely on them for my main crop, in case they don't like it here. I have a strong preference for supporting seed companies that have on-farm breeding or growing operations, and offer either an entire or a substantial selection of seed grown by organic or sustainable practices. Many seed companies are merely resellers, not breeders or even farmers, and I try to avoid those. I am delighted and reassured when it is revealed right up front exactly where the seed in a catalog comes from, besides the company's own farm, since even most of my favorite sources don't grow everything they sell. It shouldn't be a secret They should be proud to show off the exceptional stashes of genetics they have tracked down and to shine a light on those growers. If nothing is mentioned, I often email to ask. I am suspicious if there is still no clear answer and figure that's because they buy from conventional, not organic, giant seed farms in places like China, Mexico, or who knows where. Places nothing like my garden. A corollary, I admire seed companies that have taken a special interest in a particular crop, or to reinvigorating old-time open-pollinated, non-hybrid, varieties that are almost forgotten or in sorry shape and are working through the long, rigorous process of selection to do it. Speaking of which, hybrid or heirloom isn't an either-or debate. I happily grow both. I'm not content with merely the claim of non-GMO seed, which I expect from a home garden seed catalog, since transgenic hybrid seed for cotton or corn or canola or soy, for instance, is an agricultural product. GMOs are licensed to farmers for one season's use, the way we license computer software, but don't own the intellectual property of it. They're not sold outright in little packets to us. I understand why seed companies must put that on the packets and catalog covers to reassure so many shoppers worried about that topic, but I want to have more relevant information. I want to know where the seed came from. Is it organic or grown sustainably? Again, all aimed at answering whether it's a good match for my garden and ethics. Seeds I will be comfortable with and that will be at home with me. And our next topic is a wheelbarrow full of prevention. As one recent year wound down, I made a single garden resolution. Be thoughtful, keep weeding. I was reminding myself to remain focused, always and forever, on prevention, the sharpest tool an organic gardener has, of pests, weeds, and other general chaos in the coming year. Nowhere is this more the case than with plants that insist on growing in the wrong place. Our personal palette of weeds, right until the garden freezes and refuses my advances, I'm pulling more patches of garlic mustard from the moist soil and uprooting yards of vine-like ground ivy that apparently intends to keep disrespecting the lawn meets bed edge I'd cut. Against my will, that wily, wiry thing keeps creeping ever inward, overstepping the boundary, and then some. And though I will never overcome it, I can at least enforce the line of demarcation. Also on the hit list, deadheading anything noxious that's seed or fruit laden. No, I won't be hosting any garden tours anytime soon, so these last skirmishes are not about an aesthetic payoff. It's about being able to head into my own semi-dormancy, knowing that I did my best. There is no illusion. I will never have the upper hand in this delightful but labor-intensive contrivance called a garden. This momentary imposition I have imprinted upon nature, but I know better than to let everyone run totally amok because, very simply, I will hate it and be driven madder when, come spring, those outlaws have occupied even wider territories and emerged in bigger gangs. I will blame myself. So as this year began, it closes, with Margaret bending to pull more weeds, and if I am blessed to garden another year, I know the next one will start and end just exactly the same way, with the in-between part heavily punctuated by weeding too. And that is the end of this book, but I'm going to give you in the next a few minutes. It has some field guides and references and some websites and even some mail order seed catalogs. So I'll mention a few of those. And then in our next podcast, we will be going on to a new book on gardening. And first, I'm going to start with references and sources. Hardly a day passes that I do not page through a field guide or its online equivalent, seeking answers to the endless natural history questions the garden poses. Having a well-stocked shelf of field guides, or knowing the URL of related websites has enriched my relationship with the outdoors, making me a better gardener. Likewise, garden catalogs, my first points of reference decades ago when I began experimenting with plants, continued to be a source of inspiration and learning. Here, then, are some favorites from each category. And I'll just read a few of these in each category, too. And here's the field guides. And the first one is Bradley Richards, A.A., Common Spiders of North America. This would be a pretty one. Brock, Jim P., and Ken Kaufman on Kaufman Field Guide to Butterflies of North America. And then we have, there's some for beetles and glowworms. These are field guides just on specific animals. Here's Kay's Roland W. and Don E. Wilson, Mammals of North America. And I thought these would be for the gardening. But here, let's go on to websites for birds. If you want to know all about birds, Cornell Lab of Ornithology is all aboutbirds.org. And here's a Birdcast Migration Reports, or birdcast.info. And, here's a 2-minute daily national public radio show and podcast about birds, and that's birdnote.org. birdnote.org. And from Cornell, including a Right Bird, Right House tool to identify birds in your area that might benefit from nest boxes and precisely which nest box design they prefer. And that's at nestwatch.org. There's a lot of these I've never thought about. Here's another one. Everything Bluebird, from nest box protocols and plans and how to monitor them, to Bluebird biology and predator prevention information. And I know we have a lot of bluebirds in our garden, and that is SIALIS.org. And a map, here's a map your yard, and in the process, get connected with tools to foster better decisions about how to manage landscapes sustainably. And this is from Cornell and the Nature Conservancy, and that is yardmap.org. And here's a website on insects, an online community of professional and amateur naturalists. Browse for help identifying insects or even upload a photo of your own insects for expert identification. And that is at bugguide.net. And then here, let's get a couple of seed catalogs, and they're the mail order sources. And Northwest, well, that's not our area, so let's go to Maine. Here's Maine. And here, let's see, 600-plus varieties of open pollinated and hybrid certified organic seed, including many bred or grown on their Vermont farmland. So it's a little colder than here, but that's at highmowingseeds.com. And here's another one. A public access seed bank established in 1911 is how this packed list of everything describes itself. And it's at jlhudsonseeds.net. And that's the Southwest again. Let's get some open pollinated organically grown seed, including many favorite peas, marigolds, and more, bred by Alan Capular, plus edible avian tubers. And that's at peaceseedlings.blogspot.com. And it looks like run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. And we will be going to a new book on our next podcast. And be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anna Dean Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. We hope you join us.